welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, good to have you with us. Well, this weekend in Sydney, the Muslim organisation Hizb ut-Tahrir have been holding a national conference. The purpose has to look at the recent uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa. And in a press release earlier today, they state, "The Muslim world wants Islam, not secular liberalism." Well, that statement holds a wealth of discussion, and it's towards that we will give our attention this evening. Hizb ut-Tahrir also state that over 1,000 people convened in Western Sydney this morning for conference sessions. Well, tonight on Sunday night we will meet representatives of Hizb ut-Tahrir and those within the Muslim community who may not share their views. That's the issue in our first hour this evening.
But if I saw you there, I wouldn't dare dream again of opening my eyes.
Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, from the album Road Singer. That last note, that was a bass trombone, a very bass trombone. Well, over recent months, uprisings have taken place across the Middle East, and it's been broadly hailed as an Arab spring of democracy by some, or by many perhaps in the newspapers, but there are others who hope for something else, the beginning of a new caliphate, the rule of Islam. This week in Australia, supporters of the caliphate are meeting in Sydney, and they're joining us tonight in the studio. The Muslim organisation Hizb ut-Tahrir have been, their press release earlier today suggested that the Muslim world wants Islam, not secular liberalism. They suggested over 1,000 people convened in Western Sydney this morning for conference sessions. So tonight, it's good to welcome some of those from the conference. Uthman Bara is the media representative of Hizb ut-Tahrir in Australia and has been our guest on the program before. Uthman, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, John.
Also, it's lovely to welcome Dr. Mohamed Jalani of the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. I love that title, Champaign-Urbana. It gives a certain gloss
Champaign.
Around Urbana-Champaign. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
University of Chicago.
It's the same.
And you are also a member of Hizb ut-Tahrir, and here is a keynote speaker at the conference. It's also a pleasure to welcome Haythman Yunus, Associate Lecturer and tutor at Griffith University and the first to graduate from the recently established National Centre for Excellence in Islamic Studies. Haytham, welcome to you.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And our final guest is Dr. Halim Rain, Deputy Director of the Griffith Islamic Research Unit and lecturer in the National Centre for Excellence for Islamic Studies at Griffith. Halim Rain is also the author of a number of books, including Islam and Contemporary Civilization and Islam and the Australian News Media. Halim, welcome to you.
Thanks, John. Hi, how's it going?
Very, very good. Thank you. Well, let's get underway. Uthman, today, your conference, well, it's been going over the last couple of days. What sort of attendance did you have? How has the conference gone?
Well, we had a great attendance. It was a one-day conference. It was just this morning and an afternoon session. As I said, we had a bit over 1,000 people come through the turnstiles, so to speak. The discussion, as you mentioned, of the conference was about the uprisings that we've seen, momentous events, historic events, really, millions of people coming out onto the streets facing tyranny and oppression. So we wanted to discuss some of the burning questions that people had, particularly in the community, which range from the question of, well, who's behind this? Is it an independent move of the people, or is there some foreign hand behind this? Where is it taking us? What is the immediate and the long term implications for the region? And that's why I wanted to have a rigorous discussion on.
Was the discussion open to all members of the public?
Absolutely.
And yet you had a broad cross section.
Yes, it was open to everyone, public, media, even government. There were non-Muslims, obviously, naturally, because the topic is more related to Muslims, by and large, the audience was Muslim, but there was a good media presence, and there were some non-Muslims there as well. So we had that discussion, and really it was to pick on some key points that we wanted to communicate in terms of our position and our assessment on the uprisings, in terms of the need to support this, to play our role, even though we're here in Australia, to look at the intrusive and negative role that Western governments have played, given that we live here.
We'll get onto some of those issues a little later on. I noticed you did put out a 12 or 14 point statement at the end of the conference, didn't you? Later today, I think I received an email about it.
Yep, that was a summary of the key points. Yep.
Yeah. 10 points.
Yeah.
10 points.
The GST plus.
Mohammed Jilani, you're somebody who's come to Australia speaking to the conference. You've obviously taken an interest in these issues over the years. Just briefly describe for us the way in which Hizbullah Tahrir and yourself see what's happening in the Middle East at the moment.
Okay. That's a great question, John. I think... honestly, that what we are seeing today is nothing but a materialization of what has been wanting to happen for the last 50 years. In the Arab world, which is part of the third world and the Muslim world, there has been a revolution in the making for all that time, for the very simple reason that the conditions that today are being talked about, that those are the conditions that forced Bouazizi to burn himself, the people in Syria to revolt and to go against Assad, and in Egypt to topple down Mubarak. Those same conditions, corruption, poverty, unemployment, lack of justice, dictatorships, looting of the wealth of the people, those conditions have always been there. Those are not new. They have been there since the after the Second World War, the so-called independence.
And many people would say they go back even further than that.
Exactly, yeah, probably true. However, in the last 50 years, there were some conditions that prevented the revolutions from erupting. Two major conditions. One of them is the dictators, the regimes, the rulers, they have enjoyed utmost power and support of their, I would call their masters in the US, in Britain, France.
Many of those, however, were overtly secular parties, particularly those embracing a Baathist philosophy. They created animosity all around, not just within their own communities.
But still, those regimes, like for example in Syria, which is the Baath regime, the revolution that took place in the late 70s, early 80s, and persecuted more than 20,000 people in one city of Hama, that massacre did not take any single media coverage in the U.S. or in the West, because those dictators, they enjoyed the support. Why? Because they thought they are good assets for one reason or another. However, now what has happened in the last couple of years, 3 years namely, the financial crisis had a big toll on everybody, on the local people, up to the fact that there is no food on the table.
Food shortages are becoming a major issue.
And also it had a big toll on the superpowers, like even the United States, which is no longer able to support its own people, leave alone the dictators in Egypt or in other places. They didn't have the cash, if you will, to pay for these. So those conditions, they have emerged two conditions, the local conditions, which is the people absolutely tired, they've had it, they want to revolt, and the international conditions, which are no longer supportive.
That sets up the conditions in which these uprisings take place. Sure. Hizbullah Tahrir go one step further and say the uprisings themselves, if we look at them, are not simply an expression of people's hunger for democracy, but are an expression of a hunger for Islam.
Well, actually, it's the other way around. It's in the last 50 years, Hizbullah Tahrir, among other Islamic groups, have been pumping ideas into the people to overcome the shadow of fear, if you will, because Hizbullah Tahrir has realized that the people really are in deep problems. Since the destruction of the caliphate in 1924, the Muslim world, including the Arab world, has never enjoyed a single day of victory or joys or even of well-being. It has been backward, third world. A third world never jumped to a second world. That's an irony. So Hizbullah Tahrir, among other Islamic groups, have always tried and pushed on this issue. Look, Islam calls for justice. Islam calls for revolution. Islam does not approve of those regimes. But that, now, there is a time for this to materialize. It could have materialized 10 years ago. But today we think that part of the work of Hizb ut-Tahrir and other groups, because I'm not going to say exclusive here, that we've reached with the masses a level, a point of not only boiling, but beyond boiling, evaporation.
Sure. I accept all of that. But are you also saying, and this is why I read your first statement that you made out today, that this is not a hunger for a liberal democracy. This is something else. Sure. Now you're suggesting that these uprisings have a particular character to them.
They do. They do. They have a particular character. The character of the uprising of the masses is an uprising, a revolt against the current status quo.
Is it an uprising against that is Islamic rather than secular democratic?
No, it's neither. To be honest, I have been there during the whole last year. I've been with the demonstrators. Because this past year I was in Jordan all the time, and I did visit some of the Arab countries. The characteristic of the uprising is an uprising against the status quo. Nothing more, nothing less. The direction now of the masses, that is up to the ones who hold ideas and systems and can say, look, the status quo has been absolutely unjust and unfair. Where is justice and fairness going to be? For the last 50 or 60 years, the masses have heard one and only one message, that Islam has it. So today, when I raise slogan, put slogan, I want freedom, I want this, I want that, that slogans represents or expresses one and only one thing, that we've had it with the current status quo, we can take it no longer. So we take these regimes down. Now, what do we do from now on? That's up to the leaders, ideologues, people with ideas and thoughts and so on, who are now, let me mention something.
Yes, just one, briefly, because we'll need to move on.
Yeah. In Egypt, when they did the referendum on the constitution, right after the toppling down of the regime, the only massive vote was the vote of the Islamists. Okay, and everybody had a debate on this. Wow. But those Islamists, we did not see their slogans on the street. But the slogans on the street, let me tell you, those were slogans for toppling down Mubarak, Irhal, get out, leave. Those are the main things. Everything else was just not worthy even of mentioning. Go ahead.
Halim Rain, let me bring you into the conversation here. You're somebody who's made a study, a professional study, of the way in which Islamic political consciousness has developed over the last 100 years in particular, and particularly the last 40 or 50 years. What's your understanding of the Middle East at the moment?
Broadly, as Muhammad has put it, this reflects the reality that's going on the ground. I was in Syria the month before last, and a colleague of mine has been in Egypt throughout the whole of the uprisings and is still there now, gathering data for some research that we're conducting. And clearly what we see is it's a certain set of social, economic and political conditions that have given rise to the uprisings. The fundamental question here is, what is it that people are seeking? From our analysis, it clearly seems as though people are seeking freedom and democracy. They want freedom from the tyranny, the oppression, the corruption that has really plagued many of these countries over many decades now. What's interesting to note is that Islam is very important to the Middle Eastern region. That's undeniable. And it's also undeniable that the people, if they were given the freedom to choose, would want Islam to be part of politics, of the future of the state, as it, however it may turn out. But what is also clear is that people are calling for democracy. What form of democracy that'll be is still an open question, but it would be certainly one that involves representation of the people to have their will represented. But it will be one in which Islamic values and principles are respected and upheld. And I think that's the key formula that enables a party to be successful and to prosper in the current Islamic, Muslim context.
I'd like to come back in a few moments' time and address the sorts of framework that that may take, because we're seeing in different countries different expressions of the way Islamic republics develop their expressions of democracy. Haithman, let me bring you into the conversation here. As a young person, you've travelled in the Middle East, you've caught some of the spirit. What for you was most significant in travelling through those countries, talking to young people about what's happening with them?
Look, let me just first say a few words about the difference between a caliphate or a democratic system. We can't really see why a democracy, a representation of the people, political participation, white political participation, cannot live side by side with a system that is informed by Islamic values. As Dr. Reynmaz was mentioning, that Islam is a very important constituent of the life of the people and the societies in the Middle East. And we can see that. I mean, we can see after every Friday in Egypt, what was happening. They held those massive congregation prayers that included sometimes close to 1 million people around the Tahrir Square in Cairo. The people, yes, they are revolting against those repressive regimes. Most of them were somehow an asset to the West, although Hafez al-Assad in Syria was not. During the 70s and the 80s, he was an asset to the Soviet Union. So, but he was, you know, was a part of the Cold War game. That's why the massacres that were perperpetrated in Hama in 1982 were completely overlooked and not even covered by the media. Now, ironically, Hama is coming back again. Yesterday, the biggest demonstration in Syria was in Hama, and half a million people took the streets of Hama to try to call for the toppling of the son of the person who committed those atrocities in 1982. And that president had only one thing in retaliation. He sacked the governor of Hama because he apparently failed in stopping half a million people taking those streets. So we can see that across the Middle East, in Syria. In Jordan, it did gain a little bit of momentum, and then it died down when the king decided to take some reforms. Yesterday, they announced another 9 new ministers. They injected them in the government.
Haitham, we're seeing right across the Middle East, and you then mentioned Syria, but we go back to when these uprisings first began. We're seeing people putting their lives on the line day after day after day, acts of tremendous courage. What is driving them, in your opinion? What's the essence that they are fighting and hungry for?
I think the massive, enormous, sometimes unquantifiable form of injustices that they've endured over the years, I think that is the most important drive that is putting them out there. I mean, at the end of the day, what happened to Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia was that he was very poor, and he lives off a carriage that he pushes around to sell veggies and fruits, and his goods were thrown in the rubbish or something, and his carriage was confiscated by the police. So he went and self-immolated himself. It is those sort of very, very unquantifiable sometimes injustices that people are witnessing, and they can see them because they can see how the ministers and the top officials and the senior bureaucrats are living in those countries. I mean,
okay, we've dealt with, I think we've all now, the four of us, have actually stated something about the corruption of those regimes. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at now is what does replace them. Uthman, you're one of those who've spoken to me in the past about your belief that secular democracy is not the way, that Hizb ut-Tahrir advocates a return to some form of theocratic governance. Why is it that you believe that? And secondly, do you think there is any level of support for that in the Middle East? Do you think these uprisings are in a way a reflection of a hunger for that sort of return?
I think we have to make a clear distinction here. The uprisings, I think there's an agreement, broad agreement here, that the uprisings in terms of the cause are more socio-economic in terms of the situation. But then there's that question which has been raised again by a number of us in terms of the direction. Where does it go from here? And the way you find out public opinion is not by reading the slogans in Tahrir Square. I mean, a more rigorous manner is polls and surveys and research that people do. And more important than that, grassroots interaction, which we would claim confidently to have done over a very long period of time across the entire Muslim world. Whether it be that or, as I said, even polls by Western institutions have shown clearly that the role for Islam in politics and society has overwhelming support in the Muslim world. So the issue really becomes here...
How is Islam to be expressed?
Not so much that. The issue comes because the alternate sort of thing is, well, what's wrong with democracy? What's wrong with secular democracy, as Haytham asked? Well, the issue is, of course, that, he said Islamic values have to form part of it. The problem is, of course, that the most fundamental of Islamic values is that God is sovereign, right? And so it's those fundamental issues. And so for us, we believe that Islam is inextricable. It is at the essence of the Muslim world, the Middle East, North Africa, the subcontinent, and so forth. And the Muslims construct their views upon Islam. The history is Islamic. The culture is Islamic. And that is the direction in which...
And the point about God being sovereign means that ultimately you cannot have a democratic system.
Well, again, we should... Again, democracy, this is the point. The popular understanding of democracy is elections, representation, yes. Accountability.
Yes.
All of this Islam has and caters for and catered for far long before Western democracy came into existence. The issue is not with any of those. The issue is with the idea that people can legislate in absolute terms, that people... The mass of the people are the absolute source of legislation, and so.
But that's how democracy is founded. It has to be on that principle.
Well, that's fine. And that's fine. And that's where it is not compatible with Islam in that point. But that distinction is important because we don't want to send the idea that somehow we're against representation or accountability. And this, and if you keep this distinction in mind, you can understand why there are calls for democracy in Tahrir Square or elsewhere in the uprisings, because what the people, or the vast majority of Muslims mean when they say democracy is simply an expression against dictatorship. It's simply a call for representative, accountable governance. It's not to say, these are the people whose, by far, the greatest chant in the uprisings across the board would have been Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest, the Islamic insignia. So if you ask them clearly, do you think that the people in relegation of God should be sovereign, you'll get a very, very clear answer. As surveys have shown.
Halim Rain, your response.
Broadly speaking, I think what Uthman has expressed is fairly accurate. Islam needs to play a very important role in politics, but however, I think there is some differences of opinion when it comes to this issue of sovereignty. There are a number of scholars that have used this idea of, the sovereignty of God being overwhelming in the political context, and others have pointed out that this is not an accurate reflection of the meaning of the term sovereignty in the political context. But what we need to get at here is, what form of government would we be likely to see? And I think that a system that allows for another form of authoritarianism, even if it is a religious authority in power, would be something that would be rejected by the majority of people in Muslim countries even today, because theocratic type governments have been fairly well discredited across the Muslim world where they have arisen. One example would be in Iran. We saw uprisings in Iran in 2009 against that particular system. They were quite brutally repressed, and we haven't seen the Green Movement really get back on its feet since then. But broadly speaking, I don't think Muslims would be inclined to support a theocracy of some kind. There may be pockets of people who would be supportive of that, but the majority certainly, I don't think, would be. So what we'd be looking for is perhaps the model that we see in Turkey might be one that is more viable, where you have an Islamically oriented political party, although they wouldn't frame or call themselves in that respect, but an Islamically oriented political party that respects and reflects the Islamic values of the people. And as far as this issue of sovereignty in terms of legislation and lawmaking goes, there's no reason why the values and the principles of the Sharia, the Islamic law, if we can use a simple translation like that, could form the constitution of any new Islamic or Muslim democracy. And legislation is made that is consistent with the values and the principles of Islamic law. And I think that would be something that would be acceptable to a broad cross-section of Muslim populations in the Muslim world.
Dr. Jilani, if you could just elaborate on that a little, and particularly take an example like Iran, where at the moment you've had a Shia theocratic establishment, and it seems that even at the top level of that, there's no coherent agreement, where you have Ahmadinejad and Khomeini disagreeing profoundly with each other. In some way, that has to be resolved. In a secular democracy, that would be resolved by going to the people and getting the people's expression. But if you've got a rule of government where ultimately somebody interprets the will of God, then that can be a problem if people disagree on what God happens to be saying.
Yeah, perfectly all right. Hizb ut-Tahrir, probably one of the first and unique Islamic movements and collection of scholars who said, we do not want theocracy. We are against a theocratic system or state. And the Islamic state is not a theocracy. It is a human. It's a human because theocracy, it comes back from the old Middle Ages where the Pope or the one who is in charge here presents God on earth. The Khalifa, the one who succeeded Muhammad, peace be upon him, after his death, he did not represent neither Allah nor Muhammad. He did not represent, he represented the people who elected him or who gave him the allegiance to rule. That's the essence of the Islamic state. Now, the legislation, how do we arrive at a law? People today in the whole world, they do not agree on a specific way of how do we arrive at law. There are different means, different ways. Now, in Islam, we'll say we arrive at the law by referring to a text that everybody agrees on, that it's authentic and it's sacred.
But we then argue what the text means.
The text itself, see, even going back to the American Constitution, I lived there, when they talk about the founding fathers, what they meant. Now, somebody must have some particular text to say, we all agree that it's a reference, but then we interpret it. Somebody has the right to interpret it. Now, who has the right to interpret the text to get a law? The one who gets an authority from the people. Islam, in the Islamic caliphate, if I get elected as a caliph, okay, then that means the people give me the right to interpret a text that they all agree is a source of law. So this is the essence of the Islamic state. Now,
in the United States, though, for example, okay, on that question, the interpretation of the law, it's not one person, it's a panel of judges,
sure,
the Supreme Court. It's a group of people.
Sure.
And that law, yeah, can be challenged, sure, by the constituted authority vested in Congress. They can actually change the,
okay,
law.
In fact, I'm sorry to interrupt you on this, but I got your point. Actually, in the Islamic State, there are good thing and bad thing about it. The good thing is that there is a history of 1300 years of how it derived laws. And the bad thing is that for the last 100 years, we don't have one that shows us an immediate model. So we have to go to the history. And there is nothing to be ashamed of, to go to a history of existence. In the history, it was not only one or a group of people, but it was an entire collection of scholars that are scattered across the state. If you get a chance to read a book by Friedman called The Fall and the Rise of the Islamic State, where he talks about the era of those 1300 years, where the collection of the authority of the scholars that have a direct impact on the caliph, on his ministers, assistants, on the council of consultants. So that type of ability to legislate, it has not been precedented in the history of mankind. So Islam, what we are presenting in Hizb ut-Tahrir, is not something out of the blue. It is something that has been confirmed. There is a history. There is a procedure to it. And it's not a theocracy by any means. We are against theocracy. And we assure all the people of that.
Halim,
and the constitution that we have derived is exactly shows that.
Halim, a brief response.
Yeah, it's actually Noah Feldman's book that Muhammad mentioned. Yeah, that's a very important book in respect to the history of the constitutional arrangements in the Muslim world. And, you know, I think that's an important point that Muhammad makes to clarify that it's not an issue of theocracy, because this is something that wouldn't be accepted by Muslims more broadly, and that it would have to be democratic to the extent that we've already discussed in this program today.
Haitham, let me come back to you. The feeling of young people with regard to this, and this tension between a sort of secular democracy in which basically the rules are interpreted by the judges at the will of Parliament, against a view that there is some sense in which the Quran, as interpreted through Sharia, is the definitive rule. Is that argument being held in the streets at all? Do people arguing about that sort of thing, or is that a much too refined an understanding to have at the moment?
Look, obviously it is out there. There are people who are thinking that the way forward is just a mere emulation of a Western secular democracy type of thing, and the whole powers will be invested in judges who will be able to interpret and challenge constitutional arrangements. But let me go back to something that has to do with the caliphate, and maybe ask Dr. Jilani here to clarify to the audience what does Hizb ut-Tahrir exactly mean by the resurgence of the caliphate, and what type of caliphate they will think, because we know that knowing the geopolitical situation in the Arab world at the moment, it's a collection, or it's not a collection, it's just a scattered group of nation states. They were designed by the colonial powers. Is the caliphate is going to be an amalgamation of these entities, or a unification, or what is it exactly? Because as we see at the moment, people want to consolidate the power of the people in each nation state. For example, 2 days ago, I think yesterday, the results came out from Morocco after the king took the initiative to propose those constitutional reforms. We see that 72% went to the polls and participated in that. So the people want to consolidate this idea of our political participation in it.
Well, sorry to butt in there, but we really must be aware of the time. I'll get Uthman first to comment, because you haven't for a while, mm-hmm. and then we might get sure. Muhammad Jalin to respond as well.
On the question of the caliphate. Well, it's more a case, as Haitham said, the current setup in the Muslim world is pretty much a fruit of a colonial legacy, and the caliphate very much is a reversal of that, a reversal not to what was directly before that, but what was after the time of the Prophet Muhammad. In essence, obviously, technology and everything else is all good and well, and will be used, but the essence is there: the unification of the Muslim lands.
So does this mean one common form of government?
Yes, one governance, one person who is the caliph. The caliph is one after all. The lands are united. There are provinces. There's still provinces. There's still obviously the local differences, the cultural differences. That's not a problem. But there will be a centralized governance that will overlook the affairs of the Muslims. And the reference point in this will be Islam itself and the texts. And just on this point, however, again, I think the discussion about the theocracy, bringing that word into it, I think it's a Western discourse. But to be clear, if we use the word caliphate, and again, as I can point to surveys, the World Public Opinion Poll in 2007, where the word caliphate, single caliphate, uniting all the lands, these are the terminologies that have been used and put to people, and we've got results in Egypt, in Libya, in Morocco, in Pakistan, 75%, 80%, 85%, answering positively to questions like, would you like all the Muslim countries to be united in a single caliphate? But when we bring these words of theocracy or democracy, which are all a Western discourse, where people either can only refer back to some form of Western history to understand, well, what do you mean by this? And then, yes, I agree, people will be averse to these connotations.
Sorry, John, if I could just comment a little bit about that particular poll that Brother Osman mentioned. I think that the question was about the unity. So the word unification is what was appealing to the people, and not the fact that the caliphate, because a lot of people have different understandings of how the caliphate went. I mean, we're not going to go into history now, but we know how it went with the Abbasids. We know that there was that there wasn't really that centralized thing over the 1300 years. We don't want to discuss so much in the what happened in the history, but I think that in that poll and that particular question, what was appealing about that question is the unification. And when people said yes, 75%, and in some places actually went even more than 75%, they said yes to it, it's only to the fact that they're going to be united, so they will have their weight in international saying, so they will not be, or they will not feel that they are always following the Western agenda or any other agenda for that matter.
We seem to be in a situation where a lot of what we're discussing is as a reaction to 60 years of sort of Western-driven governance and now an emerging Islamic consciousness that will be expressed in a variety of ways. We're already seeing, though, experienced democracies in Islam. I'd like to talk about those in just a moment, and we can talk about Indonesia, we can talk about Malaysia, we can talk about Arab states as distinct to non-Arab states in the broad Islamic world now. But just a reminder, you're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia. This evening we're discussing the Arab uprisings in the Middle East, a conference held by Hizbut Tahrir in Australia on the Arab uprising, what it means for the Arab and Islamic world, what it means for Hizbut Tahrir in Australia, what it may mean for all of us remotely or immediately. Our guests in the studio are Dr. Mohammed Jalani of the University of Chicago at Urbana-Champaign in Illinois, Haitham Yunus, a lecturer or associate lecturer and tutor at Griffith Universities and the first graduate from the recently established National Center of Excellence for Islamic Studies, Uthman Bada, the media representative of Hizbut Tahrir in Australia, and Dr. Halim Rain, the deputy director of the Griffith Islamic Research Unit and a lecturer in the National Center for Excellence in Islamic Studies. And he's the author of a number of books, including Islam and Contemporary Civilization. Let's talk about the way things are changing and emerging. Halim Rain, this has been a particular interest of yours. Turkey is probably the best known example of Ataturk, somebody with a close connection in the minds and hearts of many Australians. For his actions in the First World War in defeating the Anzacs at Gallipoli. We accept a noble defeat. There is the young colonels establishing a democracy in Turkey, albeit a fairly authoritarian one, but that led to an evolution of a secular democracy. But it meant quite forceful putting away of some very strong Islamic traditions while that developed. You say the Turkey model is one that people can look to these days. And why? Because at the moment you seem to have a resurgence of Islam in Turkey against the Ataturk tradition.
Yeah, John, over the last decade we've seen a resurgence in, you could say, Islamically oriented political thought, whereby we've moved away from the post-colonial slogans about, you know, so much being anti-Western, about, you know, demands for something called an Islamic state on the basis of Sharia being implemented as some sort of law code, moving more towards thinking about Islam in terms of its higher objectives. And also, we've also seen a number of sort of first-generation Islamically-oriented political parties being somewhat discredited for their lack of political program. Filling that void have been what I refer to in some of my writings as a second generation of Islamically-oriented political parties that address the basic needs of people. They address issues of good governance, of government accountability and transparency, issues of human rights, issues of education and healthcare, anti-corruption, poverty reduction, and also, you know, economic prosperity and so forth. The AKP in Turkey has been, you know, fairly successful. And if we've looked at the last three elections in Turkey, we've seen they've gone from something like, 35% to 47% to 50% or something along those lines of the elections in Turkey. And the formula they have is having this very clear political program that addresses the needs and aspirations of their people, but also they are a party that reflects and respects Islamic principles and values. And, you know, even...
But they also want to become part of the West. There's still a sympathy for ultimately joining, moving into Europe.
Well, this is really a product of an evolution of you know, Muslim countries vis-a-vis the West, in that, you know, as we've come, you know, decades past the colonial period, there's less of an aversion towards those things that are Western. And I think there's a growing appreciation that human rights and democracy, as we've explained it in this program, do have a place within Islam and have had a place throughout Islamic history. So we no longer necessarily look at these things as being something of the West, that there, if we were to implement them, that would be something of a Western imposition. and so... You know, this is quite an important development in respect to the conversation we're having here today. And the success of Turkey means that it could become a model for, you know, some of these emerging political entities that do develop in the Muslim world as a consequence of these uprisings in the Arab world.
Mohammed Jilani, just your comment on Turkey as it's evolving at the moment.
Today in my speech at the conference, I explicitly mentioned Turkey should not be the model. It's not the fact that it is Islamically oriented or not. I appreciate this Islamic style of it. However, Turkey today has the largest debt in the entire Muslim world, a $267 billion debt. It has all types of prosperity and production, but most of it goes in interest to IMF and World Bank. This is definitely not the model we want. The model of the caliphate, though, which we are talking about, where Uthman mentioned about the unification. This unification by itself is not even the goal by itself. Today, the whole Muslim world, all of it, including the oil-producing countries, their GDP is less than the GDP of China alone. The oil-producing countries, all the oil, is less than Italy. It is shame. What the caliphate is what we are introducing here is unification, taking the resources in our hand, increasing the productivity, being not less dependent, but absolutely independent of the IMF and the World Bank. Turkey is not the model. Iran is not the model. Saudi Arabia is not the model. The caliphate is a new model that we are proposing, which deserves to be studied and analyzed by scholars as well as by individuals.
The problem you get with perhaps with the caliphate is that it will raise a different sort of nationalism. That is, it would be seen as Arab versus the rest. Oh. And there could be some who say, no, you're talking about Arabization.
Exactly the opposite, John. Because the essence of caliphate, the way, in fact, the name sounds, Islamic caliphate, the caliphate Islamia, means it's neither Arab. In fact, it is the only way to resolve the problems between the Kurds and the Arabs, between the Turks and the Arabs on the border of Syria, between the Kashmiri issue between Pakistan and India. The only way to resolve those nationalistic, racial type of things. In fact, read Bernard Shaw what he says about Islam, where he says Islam was the only one that was able to resolve conflicts between nations. And that's what caliphate is about.
We're going to have to take some calls. And Haithman, I'll get you to respond briefly just while we take a couple of calls. So can you give us a brief response to what Mohammed Jilani has just said? Just a brief comment, and then we'll take some calls.
I think his take on Turkey may be a little bit overstated. I'm not really sure about the numbers that he stated in terms of public debt. But certainly everyone knows that Turkey is doing well in terms of their economics, and that was recently reflected by them.
But what about the idea of this notion of the caliphate as expressed?
Sorry?
What about the nature of the caliphate as expressed?
Well, the way that Dr. Jilani is putting it, as if it's going to be all smooth and it will happen easily. I don't see it happening, given the realities and the context in the Muslim world at the moment, and especially in the Arab world. I think what we are moving into here is a more form of public participation in the political process in the Arab world, merely for the purposes of having a say into the system And possibly if the governments were so reflective of that, then we will have a little bit of improvement into people's lives. And I think that should be the ultimate goal of any reform to any political system, is to improve the lives of the people.
Immediate local improvement. Let's take a couple of calls. Patrick from Swan Hill is on the line. Hello, Patrick. What would you like to say briefly? Yeah. Just a question.
Yeah, good day, John. It seems to me there's a correspondence between the present trends in Islam and the Enlightenment, Renaissance Enlightenment in Europe, where in Western societies they threw off the power of the clerics, they liberated themselves. That is us. I'm one of them, and now we have freedom. We can still have our own religion. If in Islamist world, if they did the same thing, if they had their own enlightenment, as I see it brought on, I think it's being brought on now by the internet and such things, they are now being enlightened as to their possibilities. They can still be Muslims, they can still practice their religion, but not be ruled by clerics.
Okay, this is a key question that's opened up here. Uthman.
Okay, if I can just humbly mention to Patrick and the audience, the analogy just goes only so far. The key difference, of course, is that pre-Enlightenment, the situation of Europe under Christianity was worlds apart from how the Muslim world at that time was under Islam, a flourishing, very civilised and forward-looking way. And that's
sure,
the point.
But you are talking about giving clerics a role in government, and in some way a determinative role in government.
Not clerics. We're saying there's a reference point, and certainly to there's a level of qualification to interpret that as lawyers and legal experts. It's not, we wouldn't put it like that, but the point is the same, right? The assumption is this leads to that, but you're using a European example, a very specific historical, geographical and ideological context. And I think, but that points to a broader point here, really, whether it's a Turkish model or this model or democracy. I mean, in the end, what are we saying here? Turkey's a good model. It's moving towards democracy. Where is it going to end up? Like the United States or Europe?
Well, let me give you a practical example. People will say today, look, the situation in Malaysia. A person, you got a confusion over religious law and secular law, where people, for instance, are not free to choose their religion. A person cannot convert. It could not convert to Christianity without incurring, a woman could not convert to Christianity without incurring the wrath of her family and bringing down the state, the law of the state against it. Now, that's a confusion of religion and freedom.
There are a myriad of problems in the current systems in the Muslim world. That's why we call for change. But the broad point that I would make is still the same, that it's a question of the direction. Are we moving towards, if we're going to move towards democracy, you're going to end up where, in the United States or Australia or Europe? The reality is, let's face the reality, if we step back from the forest here a little bit, or from the trees here, that under Western leadership, where has the world ended up? Let's look at the poverty levels around the world, the economic situation, the social situation, the crime levels. I mean,
it's not bad here in Australia.
No, but it's not just Australia, you see. It's a global village. It's a global village. We're not going to, we'd be selfish to say it's fine here, but our foreign policy is doing that over there. Western leadership has led the world for so many decades, and it has led the world into, I would say, a moribund graveyard, where 80% of the world lives under $10 a day, where half of the world's children live in poverty.
That's called the free enterprise capitalist system. So that's a critique of an economic system rather than a democratic political system.
They're one and the same.
Some would argue with you on that.
That's what's implemented, and the only alternative really for the world after the failure of socialism is Islam, so let's consider it in an impartial manner.
A quick call from Abbas in Sydney. Abbas, how are you? Welcome. What would you like to say, very briefly?
Yeah, how are you going, guys?
Good. Very quickly.
I would like to talk about, if you say Turkey is an example, that you let Islam be in Turkey, and Turkey became very moderate, very, very diplomatic in its way. Why don't you just let Islam be in the rest of the world? I mean, why not? Why keep button your nose in Middle Eastern politics? You know, let it be, let it have its way, and see what will come, what will evolve it. People will seek employment, seek everything in life, just like we do here.
Halim Rain, a brief response.
I think that, that's a fair point. A lot of the problems that the Muslim world have faced over a number of decades now have been due to the interference of external powers. That's not the whole story, though. I mean, there are a number of problems that have been internal that need to be addressed as well. And I think that that's, you know, one of the great things about these uprisings that have taken place is that it's now giving an opportunity for a fresh start. And, you know, to a large extent, the Western world has had to take a step back and recognize and appreciate that many of their policies in the Muslim world over a number of decades now have been detrimental to the basic lives of ordinary people and those nations, you know, as a whole.
30 seconds. Mohammed Jalini, last word.
Okay. The revolutions are taking place all over the Arab world, at least. Now, regimes are down. So let's put the question to the people. To the people. What system would you like to choose? And now, capitalism in the economy. Would you like to use capitalism, nationalism, socialism, or Islamic economy? Just on this issue, and let me see what the people say. I bet it will be Islam.
More to be seen. The future will tell. You've been on Sunday Nights. Thanks to Mohammed Jalani, Uthman Barah, Haytham Yunus, and Halim Rain. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.